morning. We want to welcome you all to our second case this morning, but we especially welcome Ellsworth High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class, and we invite high school students and other students to come and hear an oral argument and discuss the procedures and processes of this court. And Ellsworth High School has come. They have received materials relating to this case, and they will meet at lunch time right after this case with Justice Crooks, who's been assigned to be the participating justice today. If anyone in this room would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, would you raise your hand and we'll get you a summary? As the marshal is distributing the summaries, let me introduce the court to you all. I should say counsel and everyone else are invited to this lunch meeting. This is not a private session. It is a public open session.
However, there's no lunch.
They all know there's okay. No free lunch. To my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice in charge at lunchtime, without lunch. Today, I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's right is an empty chair. Justice David Prosser ordinarily sits there. Justice Prosser is not participating in the December oral argument cases. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call their second case, 10 AP 2061, Fond du Lac County versus Helen E.F. Arguing for Fond du Lac County is attorney William J. Bent. Counsel?
Please the court. I am William Bent. I'm the Corporation Counsel for Fond du Lac County, and under Section 51.04, I represent the interests of the public in matters under Chapter 51 of the Wisconsin Statutes. First, we do not contend that Alzheimer's is a mental illness. Rather, Helen E.F. developed a set of conditions clearly documented in the record, shown by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that included behavioral disturbances of agitation, anxiety, and depression that constitute a mental illness for purposes of involuntary commitment.
A court should not. You say she didn't have a mental illness. Now you're saying it was a mental illness under Chapter 51. Is that right?
No, Alzheimer's itself is okay. Not a mental illness.
All right.
But that she did develop a set of conditions that constituted a mental illness.
But Alzheimer's is not a mental illness. What caused her conditions?
The cause of a mental illness under the statute is unknown, actually. It's not an element of proof. No one knows what causes schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, or even depression.
She may have had any one of those.
What she had was a condition that, in Dr. Roski's opinion, in his medical judgment, constituted a mental illness for purposes of involuntary commitment.
And what was the mental illness?
What she had, Dr. Roski described them as behavioral disturbances that were associated with the Alzheimer's dementia.
Is agitation, I don't know if you use DSM-3 anymore, probably it's DSM-12 by the time I catch up with it, but that's what you use and what mental health specialists use or used to use for purposes of defining what was a mental illness. Is agitation a mental illness?
Agitation, yes, can be a mental illness.
It seems to me that's a symptom rather than a mental illness.
It's a disorder. The statute defines a mental illness for purposes of involuntary commitment in descriptive terms.
Yes.
Not in diagnostic terms. And those descriptive terms are substantial disorder of thought, mood, or perception, orientation, or memory that grossly impairs judgment, behavior, capacity to recognize reality, or ability to meet the ordinary demands of life, but does not include alcoholism.
That's what,
5101-13B.
Then why are you conceding that Alzheimer's is not a mental illness? It seems to me that Alzheimer's would fall into that description, and it's not accepted like alcoholism is.
The reason would be there's more going on. Alzheimer's is not a disease that someone has that everyone has the same symptomology. And the same characteristics that would constitute a mental illness may not exist in every case where somebody has Alzheimer's. I suppose an argument could be made that it is, but I believe the better argument is that you look at the condition and does it meet the statutory criterion, and if it does, it's a mental illness for purposes of involuntary commitment. A court should not rule as a matter of law that a person with Alzheimer's who meets involuntary commitment standards cannot be involuntarily committed for merely having Alzheimer's.
Well, 13, let's see. The definitions in 51.01, do they apply here?
The definition that applies here is 51.01-13B.
Right.
That should be the only definition that applies to whether someone has a mental illness.
Mental illness means a substantial disorder, right?
Correct.
Of thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory, which impairs judgment, behavior, capacity, et cetera, to meet the ordinary demands of life. So you're saying mental illness has a very strange definition here.
It's not a strange definition. It's a descriptive one. It's one that allows, the legislature allowed the process of identifying or diagnosing that mental illness to be done in descriptive terms rather than diagnostic terms. But clearly, these have meaning. They're disorders, and Helen E.F. had these disorders.
So
Mr. Baird,
go ahead.
I'm just wondering what it was that the county gained by moving this from a Chapter 55 protective placement to a Chapter 51 mental illness commitment. What was the need to move from 55 to 51?
She needed treatment.
Did she get treatment under 55? I looked at Chapter 55 in terms of, as an example, the involuntary administration of psychotropic and other such medications. It's permitted as long as you follow the statute under 55. Why did she have to get 51? Now, I understand that 51 involves the police. It involves removing the person from the protective placement. It involves transporting that person to a mental health facility and basically an emergency detention, an involuntary detention. What was gained?
What was gained was that she was receiving treatment that she needed in order to cease being a danger to herself and to others. She couldn't be treated in a nursing home setting. The Chapter 55 does not allow someone to be treated on an inpatient psychiatric unit. That is the safest, most appropriate place for the administration of psychotropic medication. When you're beginning that process, you need to get the right kind, and you need to get the right level of medication, and you need to be monitored. All of that happens on a psychiatric unit where doctors and nurses can observe how you're doing. That does not happen in a nursing home where the psychiatrist is not there. Nursing homes don't have that kind of access to psychiatrists.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding. She gets treated at the mental health facility with psychotropic medication. She could have been treated under the Chapter 55 placement, the protective placement, with the medication. Psychiatrists are regularly consulted in nursing home facilities, oftentimes depending on the patients, visit on a regular basis. 5514 permits the involuntary administration of psychotropic medication. So I'm still having trouble understanding why you take a person out of her placement, you have the police come, handcuff her, and remove her to the mental health facility to give her basically the same treatment.
First of all, she wasn't handcuffed. I mean, there are regulations in place that police need to regard in using the least restrictive safeguarding as necessary. Basically, she was wheeled over there in a wheelchair, but she couldn't be treated in the nursing home setting. She needed to be in a psychiatric unit. This was somebody who was physically aggressive towards staff members. She was hitting them. She was punching them. She was kicking them. She was refusing to cooperate with care because she had lost the ability to cooperate with care. She had developed a UTI, urinary tract infection, and Dr. Roski testified he believes it was because she wasn't cooperating with necessary care for hygiene. Basically meaning that she was lying in urine and not allowing them to care for her. She was a danger at that time to herself and to others. Dr. Roski said clearly in that she actually had a danger of increased infection, medical illness, or even mortality. In order to bring a Chapter 55, you don't get that overnight. That takes 30 to 60 days to get a guardianship order. In addition to that, you either have to have a finding of probable cause in a Chapter 51 or a settlement agreement in a Chapter 51 or a commitment in a Chapter 51. Those are all involuntary commitment procedures or a finding that she meets the dangerousness standards under Chapter 51. So
if you assume that she was handcuffed, but I did pay attention to the task force report that was done in Milwaukee County about whether 55 or 51 should be used. It's, of course, referred to at some length in the Court of Appeals decision. And there they describe handcuffing in most instances. I had 19 years on the trial bench up in Brown County, and from time to time I presided over hearings under Chapter 51. And it certainly was not unusual that people were brought by the police to the Brown County Mental Health Center using handcuffs. So I apologize for assuming that happened in this case, but I know it does happen on a regular basis. Do you disagree with that?
It can happen if that is necessary. If a police officer will use the least restrictive force necessary to do an emergency detention. Again, you're dealing with somebody who is expressly a danger to themselves or others. And, you know, the lesser of two evils might be the handcuffing, but what you're doing is bringing them to a place where they can be evaluated for their mental illness and, if appropriate, treated to alleviate that dangerousness. That was necessary in this case. That nursing home had come to me and explained everything that was going on, and she could not remain there. And it needed immediate attention.
Now, I'm on the same page as Justice Crooks for the moment, namely, why use 51 instead of 55? Now, 5512 provides for an order for protective services or protective placement. And under sub 2, protective placement may be made to a public medical institution and to other appropriate facilities, but may not be made to units for the acutely mentally ill. And 55 defines mentally ill, too, I should say also. And there defines mentally ill as a disease to the extent that the afflicted person requires care. So you can't send them to an institution for the mentally ill, but you can send them to an appropriate facility or public medical institution. Why can't
right,
we be
that,
using 55?
But that would not include a psychiatric facility. She had a health care power of attorney. Healthcare agent does not have the authority to admit a principal to a psychiatric facility.
Sometimes
so
you...
That, excuse me, but that option was just not available. And even if we wanted to consider that option, you can only get such an order after a guardianship and protective placement, which takes up to 60 days to obtain.
So you can't do anything in that 60 days?
What you need to make sure you're doing is protecting the subject individual.
And are you telling me that in that 60 days, hands off?
In that 60 days time, what you do at the time, you use the tools that are allowed in the statute.
Which
and
are?
One of the tools is a petition for examination under Section 51.20, which was
okay.
Used.
Why not? And I understand what you're saying, but something that's all, a tool that's also used on occasion is that you bring someone in Chapter 51, and then it is subsequently converted to a Chapter 55. The statute provides for that explicitly.
But that is not, she didn't need protective placement. She was already in a nursing home. She was there because a healthcare agent had admitted her to the nursing home in the past. She had been there for about 6 years. And she was not able to cooperate with the care that they were providing her at that nursing home.
Yes, but once you get into 55, there's a panoply of rights and responsibilities that come into play, including, as was referenced earlier, the administration of psychotropic medications.
Those are decisions. I represent the interests of the public under Chapter 51.04, and those are decisions that the Corporation Council is required to make. They're not made because we want to commit somebody. They're made because it's necessary to do that to protect them from danger and to protect the public from danger. And in the meantime, she's striking out at caregivers. She is not cooperating with nutrition, with medication, with any kind of care.
Counselor, isn't that those criteria that you speak about, criteria that many older people suffer when they have some form of dementia? It doesn't have to be Alzheimer's, but it can be any other kind of aging process that tends to make people perhaps not as
collegial with those that are trying to help them as they might have been were they younger.
But this is not somebody who wasn't merely collegial. This isn't somebody who's merely a difficult patient. This is somebody who met the standards for involuntary commitment. And while it is certainly plausible to say, why not use Chapter 55, the fact of the matter is that Chapter 51 is available, and at times it is the best remedy to use, the best solution for the person. And that's what the law allows. Anyone who meets the criterion for involuntary commitment, who meets those standards for involuntary commitment, can be committed. There's no exception. The only disqualifying condition that was in the definition is alcoholism, and there's another process if you need to be committed for alcoholism. But if you meet the standards, you can be committed.
Mr. Bennett, let me just clarify procedurally what occurred here. My understanding is there was a petition for a 51 commitment. The court commissioner looked at this and said, no, you don't meet the criteria for a 51 commitment, and proceeded with a Chapter 55 commitment. And then later, there was a petition to convert the 55 to 51. Is that correct?
No, you're partially correct. There was an initial proceeding that occurred as a result of an emergency detention. And the reason why that matter was converted was because the belief that Helen E.F. had a urinary tract infection that was mimicking the same behaviors that might be occurring if you have a mental illness. And that seemed to be the most sensible, compassionate approach. And so that is what happened. It was converted to a Chapter 55, and they did treat her urinary tract infection.
It was converted from a 55 to a 51?
It went from a 51 to a 55 initially. And
the petition was for 51. The commissioner found 55 was appropriate.
There was it was actually moved. There was an agreement to do that. The county moved, and the reason was because of the doctor believing that she did have a urinary tract infection. But when they treated the urinary tract infection, her behaviors didn't change. And after 30 days, or nearly 30 days, it was obvious that protective placement was not the answer, and that a Chapter 51 was necessary in order to stabilize her condition, in order to treat her condition. She benefited greatly by this treatment.
But what was the reason for moving her in her wheelchair off the unit and then back onto the unit?
Because
I never understood that.
Okay, she was on the unit, and remember that initially was a Chapter 51, even though it was converted. And there's case law that says you cannot piggyback detention periods. If you're going to have another detention, it has to be based on a new detention order, on a new set of facts. And that petition was based upon behavior that occurred after that first preliminary hearing. And we applied to the court for a new detention order. And I felt it was necessary for her to be discharged from the unit, even if it was just for a few minutes, to break that detention because of the existence of that case law. Then she was brought back on under the detention order that was signed by the circuit court judge from Fond du Lac County.
So the detention was broken by the moving off the unit,
right,
and then back on.
So there was a subsequent detention. There was no other place for her to go.
You know, there are some issues in interpreting statutes. There are almost always issues in interpreting statutes. They're written for the general situations that may come up, and the kinds of cases we get are always the ones that are not quite what we look at. And the way to interpret statutes, of course, is not only through their plain meaning and their legislative history, but to see if there are holes so that one assumes the legislature didn't intend a hole in these statutes to let Helen, Ms. Helen, or someone like her fall through and not be protected, right?
That is correct. I think Chapter 51 and 55 interplay with each other very well. You can be actually under both of those chapters at the same time. You can meet the requirements for the criteria for protected placement and for a commitment. And there are some people who are on both if that is what's needed.
One of the things that's a little confusing, I think, is to define the same words differently. So in Chapter 51, mental illness is defined in A in a particular way. In Chapter 55, in 5501 4M, as I see it, it has the exact same definition as in 5101 13A. Then you get the words mental illness very differently defined for purposes of involuntary commitment, which is, I think, a confusing way of handling this, the statute. And so probably what it's defining is behavioral disorders. That, well, you can't do that because that's something that may be under something else, but it's a behavior idiosyncratic or idiosyncratic behavior or dangerous behavior.
It is. The legislature decided to create a separate definition for those who are mentally ill for purposes of involuntary commitment. And that is the purpose for 5101.13b. And it's purposely different from other definitions. It's probably a stronger definition.
It's more broad.
It's broad, but it also is part of very strict standards. You have to be a danger to yourself or others as well as being a proper subject for treatment. She met all three of those criteria. And then the medical judgment this court has ruled in the commitment of Dennis H. that whether someone is mentally ill is a medical judgment. And in Dr. Roski's medical judgment, she was mentally ill for purposes of involuntary commitment, and that was uncontroverted evidence in the record. There was no evidence to the contrary in the record.
I understand that. And he can't say she's mentally ill under psychiatric treatment, or DIS. He has to say she's mentally ill as mental illness is defined in 13B.
That
so
is,
it's a legal issue.
That's correct.
A legal definition that he gives.
Well, but this court indicated in that was a commitment case that's a medical judgment, and he offered that judgment, and there was no opinion offered by anyone else contrary to that.
Is there a difference of who pays for any of this, depending on whether it's 51 or 55 or some sub-things? County pays for her care?
That would depend upon the source. The county ultimately would be responsible for the care.
Whether if she it was 51 or 55?
That would be correct. I mean, we now have family care that would pay for a Chapter 55, a stay in a nursing home, for instance. There's Title 19 if you're on medical assistance. There's private funds. People sometimes pay for it privately. County cannot turn anyone away for lack of ability to pay. That payment is not an issue in these cases. We bring them, and if the person doesn't have any money to pay for it, then I've got a red light here.
You may continue.
Okay.
You may continue on the subject I asked you a question about.
Yeah, and that payment is really irrelevant.
Okay. I was talking about payment between the state and the county. get state reimbursement for one and not the other. Well, the court's very sensitive to mandates on the county.
Okay, it can be. In this particular case, she was in a private hospital, so the county was not paying for it. There was other means of paying for it. She was at St. Agnes Behavioral Health.
And had she been at a public institution? If she had been at a public institution, who would have had to pay?
That would have been, Fond du Lac County operates a psychiatric unit, and that payment would be based upon an ability to pay that is determined by the statutes and the administrative code.
Right. Inability to pay?
Correct.
Would pay.
The county basically would then, we have fixed costs in operating the facility.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Donald T. Lang, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Helen E.F.
May it please the court, Don Lang, appearing on behalf of Helen, the respondent appellant. The issue here today, the major issue, is whether or not Chapter 51 authorizes the involuntary commitment of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient who engages in difficult behavior in a treatment facility or a nursing home. The question here isn't whether or not there was a need for some intervention. The question here is, where is that intervention been authorized by the legislature? The Court of Appeals concluded that 51 did not authorize the commitment of a person with a degenerative brain disorder such as Alzheimer's. And there are basically four points I hope to address through the course of my argument today. The first is that a fair reading of the statutes, including a reading of both 51 and 55 and the legislative policy statements introducing those chapters, supports the Court of Appeals' conclusion that 51 does not authorize this type of commitment. Commitments, of course, are an awesome exercise of government power. We ought not to lightly infer that such a power has been authorized absent some clear indication. Secondly, contrary to the county's suggestion, recognizing that Alzheimer's patients cannot be committed under 51, or people with Alzheimer's and have behavioral disturbances cannot be committed under 51, does not mean that there are no services available and that there's somehow a big hole in the commitment mental health process. On the contrary, there's basically nothing in this case that could be done under Chapter 51 that could not otherwise have been done under Chapter 55.
Walk me through exactly what you would have had them do. Instead of filing the 51 or proceeding under 51, you would have had them proceed under 55. Walk me through exactly how that works.
Oh, sure. Now, in this case, if they just didn't let the 55 time limits lapse, we could have had a 55 commitment, and we wouldn't be here today to discuss this. It's only because the 55 time limits lapsed that it was initiated yet again as a 51.
Okay, but assuming so that if it wouldn't have lapsed and she was still in a protective placement under 55, what would you have had them do instead of starting a 51?
Well, in this instance, you could have initiated an emergency placement under 55-13, filed a petition.
And you get into court right away like you do with a 51?
There is a requirement that there be a probable cause hearing within 72 hours, and there can be an authorization for psychotropic medications immediately under 5410, I believe it is, so that the access to psychotropic medications isn't contingent on being in a locked 51 facility. 55 independently authorizes psychotropic medications.
I'm trying to figure that out. Psychotropic medications involuntarily administered would be administered where? How would that work for her?
Where she was in the nursing home, she was getting psychotropic medications.
Involuntarily administered?
I'm not sure, but she was getting them. Oftentimes they're sprinkled in food and the like, by consent of the guardian, and
right,
it's resolved that way.
Oftentimes, involuntary medication is not a pleasant process, and they need to be very closely monitored so that they're safe during that process. I'm just trying to figure out how it would happen for her. How would this exactly go down for this woman?
And it would be done through an emergency detention and then authorization under Chapter 54, Chapter 5414 to authorize the psychotropic meds. I mean, certainly contrary to the representation here, you don't have to be under 51 to get safely medicated. Otherwise, we have the legislature authorizing medication under 55 dangerously at whim. But obviously, every day it's being authorized under 55. And the mechanism is to file emergency detention. And once that's done,
does she stay in her same room in the same place? Is that how that works in your mind?
Not necessarily, no. And it's not clear how that would have worked here. She was obviously moved from where she was originally staying when this was converted to a 55. But then the time limits lapsed, and then it was restarted as a 51. Again, if the time limits had not lapsed, there would have been no reason not to just do a 55.
You had two other points. You said there were four points.
Oh,
you did what
sure.
I labeled as the plain language of 51. There's no hole. It could be done under Chapter 55, your third point.
Thirdly, even if 51 did not categorically prohibit the involuntary commitment of an Alzheimer's degenerative brain disorder person, that in this particular instance, Helen is just not a proper subject for treatment. That while you can make her calmer so that she'll accept daily living care, her functional ability is simply not going to improve, which is the sad reality of Alzheimer's patients. And CJ itself recognizes there's a difference between treating a disorder and simply treating behaviors. And essentially, in this instance, all we're doing is treating some behaviors. The disorder, unfortunately, cannot be treated, and she cannot be rehabilitated as required under 51.
Does something like schizophrenia go away if it's treated?
No, but it's remarkably well subject to treatment. Now, it will vary from patient to patient, but it's not uncommon to have a patient with schizophrenia who's acutely ill come in, and then they find the right medications, and those individuals can function quite well in society and will never return to the 51 system. Bipolar disorder, acute cases. I mean, there's a number of illnesses that medications work wonderfully. Usually, whether that person returns or stays in the system is going to be contingent on their willingness to acknowledge their need for the medication. If they acknowledge that need, oftentimes they won't be back at all. If they don't, then they may stay.
Sometimes the medications need to be changed. The same mix doesn't work later in time as it did earlier in time. So sometimes they need to change the complexion of the medication the person's taking. Once they do that, then they're able to function again. And then every now and then you see them back. At least that's been my experience. Not everyone, but that's some people. But you're saying with Alzheimer's, there's nothing that helps their behaviors.
Well, the behaviors can be managed to the extent that they get calmer, but the condition itself can't be managed. Their functional level doesn't improve. It's simply that they're more docile, I guess, is probably a cynical way to view it, but they're just easier to provide day-to-day care. But that isn't what rehabilitation is. And the whole 55 system is designed for people such as an Alzheimer's patient who essentially are not going to get better. They're going to need lifetime care, and we provide that care. 51 is a more confrontational system. In effect, it's the government intervening, confining an individual, and basically requiring them to get treatment. With the hopes
55
that we're going to
is more confrontational.
Excuse
55
me?
Is more confrontational. No. 51
is basically this more adversarial system. 55 system is more of a family-friendly system. In many instances, it will be the family that initiates the process. When we provide notice, it's not just notice to the attorney and the patient. You provide notice to the guardian, the agent, if there's a healthcare agent. You provide notice to the attorney and to family members, heirs, they refer to it as the statute. So the statute sort of anticipates this sort of helping hand component. And then once there is a commitment or the proceeding is going on, the guardian is basically there throughout the process to keep an eye on things, essentially. And many steps in the process, such as moving them to a different facility, require input from the guardian in the process.
Counsel, one way of looking at this case initially is if the doctor said she's mentally ill and subject to 51, end of story. There's no contravening evidence. But my that's it. You're out. Too bad. But my problem is, when I looked at the doctor's report, it appears to me that it is her dementia that qualifies as a mental illness. The doctor says the following. Her dementia qualifies as a, and then he quotes verbatim the words of how mental illness is defined in chapter 51.01.13b. Mm-hmm. He defines it verbatim. So that's her dementia qualifies as a substantial disorder of thought, mood, and perception that grossly impairs her judgment, behavior, capacity to recognize reality and the ability to meet the ordinary demands of life, period, quotation marks. That's right out of the definition. So he's saying she qualifies for being mentally ill because of her dementia. Then on the next page, it is more generic, opinions regarding civil commitment. She suffers from a mental illness as defined in WSSTAT 551.01.13b. And so that's her mental illness. So it seems to me the record before us is that her dementia is her mental illness. Now, clearly, he says her symptoms of dementia can be treatable, her dementia cannot be. But in order to be committed under 51, you have to have a mental illness. He defines her mental illness, the only report that's here, he defines her mental illness as dementia.
I'm concerned here. I think the state is trying to parse the doctor's testimony, severing the mental disorder from the behaviors that are occurring. And I don't think that that's a fair reading of the record, that these behaviors are inextricably linked to the disorder. In fact, they're manifestations of the disorder.
Well, assuming Alzheimer's is, as the doctor said in his report, he says her dementia qualifies as a substantial disorder of thought, mood, and perception, etc., following the definition of mental illness. Assuming that Alzheimer's is a mental illness as defined in 13B, hasn't the legislature said, doctor, you tell us if someone is mentally ill that can fit the standard, we've set the standard, she's a 51, because she meets the standard of mental illness in 51, because of her Alzheimer's, not because of the symptoms.
Well, I think one of the difficulties analyzing this case is that the definition in 51.01.13 B is a sort of this open-ended functional definition. But I don't think that definition can be understood without recognizing the context in which the whole system is set up.
But the definition was the exact definition used by this doctor as the basis of his opinion that she was mentally ill and subject to a civil commitment under.
Yeah, and I understand, but my contention would be Dr. Rowski isn't the arbiter of what the legislature has authorized in terms of who qualifies and does not qualify for commitment.
So what do you want this court to say?
That a person with a degenerative brain disorder cannot be committed under Chapter 51 based on that degenerative brain disorder.
Can you say that after 13B, this is Alice in Wonderland. They define mental illness however they want. The word mental illness did not have to be used in the definition. It could have been a behavioral disorder, right? Or degenerative behavior, meaning a substantial disorder of thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory, which grossly impairs judgment, blah, 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 blah. What do you have to say about that?
And they could have. But defining mental illness, again, can't be read in isolation from the statements of policy, which include degenerative brain disorders as something to be addressed under 55, but doesn't list them whatsoever as a condition to be addressed under 51.
If they defined it the way I did and didn't use the word mental illness, would you be here?
I might be, but it would be a more difficult.
You'd have a very tough time.
Yeah.
You're fighting because they're using the term mental illness, which has a definition that we're accustomed to, whether it's broader or less, or we agree with it, but it means some kind of mental disorder, not a degenerative disease ordinarily, right?
The problem is, if you just focus on the definition of mental illness in isolation, that's it, 13B, you have, in my mind and in the doctor's mind, Alzheimer's or dementia fits it. He quoted it verbatim, but it isn't in isolation because he goes on to say that dementia can't be treated. The mental illness cannot be treated. You have, what is it, 3 or 4 criteria. You have to have a mental illness. You have to be a proper subject for treatment. That means some rehabilitation. And isn't that the nut here, that Alzheimer's is the mental illness, but that mental illness is not a proper subject for treatment under 51 because it isn't subject to rehabilitation. Am I wrong or right on that? Can you address?
Not only is it not subject to rehabilitation, but I think it's excluded from consideration by its placement and focus in Chapter 55, and it's seeming exclusion by the legislature in 51.
Mr. Lang, what's the difference? Does it really make any difference whether the commitment here is under 51 or 55? Why is it important?
Well, it's important on a number of levels. One is, again, where these people are placed and versus potentially a locked unit with an Alzheimer's patient next to a dangerous schizophrenic, theoretically. But also there's the components of having a guardian and someone who's keeping an eye on the system, the purpose of the system being to care for the person, not to try to treat the person. I mean, Chapter 51 and 55 have completely different functions, focuses, and which makes entirely good sense why an Alzheimer's patient would be in 55, because the focus there is to make sure they're being cared for, not to try to formally treat them.
Not every 51 is in a locked, guarded facility. Most of them aren't. I mean,
there might be an initial, right.
I mean, the whole goal is to get these people functional and out in society and you know, have their behaviors such that and their illness treated such that they can go forward and not be a danger to themselves or someone else.
But 51 authorizes it.
But what I heard you say...
And so there's a difference in whether or not that person will or will not be is going to tell a lot of circumstances.
And 55 does not authorize someone to be in a locked facility?
I think it may under some circumstances of special order, but I'm not actually certain of that
answer.
Okay.
So you're saying the legislative intent was for Alzheimer's patients to not be in a locked facility?
Okay. And in 55 and... Yeah, 55 in particular indicates that they cannot be 55 patients in a locked psychiatric treatment unit, which is a 51 unit.
Yeah, but under 55, can you be in a locked facility?
And that's what I'm not precisely certain about.
Okay, fair enough.
If it would be, it would be for purposes of care because they might wander or something, but I don't know.
Right, I mean, that's not uncommon depending on where they are in the stage and really high-level good treatment facilities. Sometimes people with advanced stages of Alzheimer's need to have some additional protection, right?
Yeah, they, They often do.
But you think that you don't know if that's allowed under 55?
Not certain.
Okay, fair enough.
Counsel, treatment, proper subject for treatment. So you need mental illness, and you need to be a proper subject for treatment. Now, what does the legislature say treatment means? In 51.0117, it defines treatment. And so the mental illness has to be a proper, has to be subject to treatment. And it means brings about rehabilitation of a mentally ill, alcoholic, drug-dependent, or developmentally disabled person.
Yeah, and this is one of the series of definitions in the statute that don't include degenerative brain disorders. And the definition of a treatment facility, the definition of treatment, the statement of policy don't include those. And again, it makes sense because those individuals are treated under 55. When 55 was first adopted back around, was it 1973, it was originally proposed as treating senile individuals. But the Assembly bill amended that, and they made it infirmities of aging. And then we get up to the 2005 revision, and they adopted the phrase degenerative brain disorder because while it involves the same debilitating condition as a infirmities of aging, Alzheimer's was recognized to be something that isn't necessarily linked to age, though it often and usually is. And so they wanted the definition to include what really is going on, and that is there's a degeneration of the brain. I want to get back to something just briefly, and that is Dr. Rowski's own testimony. He doesn't sever out the behavior from the mental disorder. And even his own testimony, page 6, dementia, especially Alzheimer's, can also involve behavioral disturbances. Page 13, referring to Helen's medicines, that two of Helen's medicines were prescribed for the behavioral disturbances associated with dementia. And then on redirect, which is really, I think, captures it all, at the end of the hearing on page 14, he confirmed that the behavioral disturbances he was talking about resulted from the Alzheimer's, independent of any urinary tract infection. So to suggest that somehow that we're just treating a behavioral disturbance or something independent of the Alzheimer's, I think is just not tenable on this record. The fact of the matter is that these behaviors are what Alzheimer's produces, and Alzheimer's patients tend to produce these behaviors. But it doesn't authorize commitment under Chapter 51. And if the legislature had intended to do so, they could have easily included degenerative brain disorders in the statement of legislative policy.
So where do they cover degenerative brain disorder in Chapter 51?
It's defined, but it's defined in its exclusion what it doesn't involve. It's not a serious mental illness. It's not alcoholism. It's not these other things. At no point does the legislature say this is chapter's designed to treat this condition. And again, it makes sense that it isn't because the condition really isn't treatable or rehabilitatable.
So we have a definition, permanent. But I can't find a particular provision that says here's what we're going to do with people with degenerative brain disorders.
Well, again, that's you'll find in the various definitions of Chapter 55, the statement of legislative policy, the description of facilities speak of degenerative brain disorders.
That's 55.001, Declaration of Policy. It says that recognizes that many citizens, because of degenerative brain disorder, are in the need of protective services, right?
That's correct.
And it defines degenerative brain disorder. I thought it defined it pretty much the way it's defined in 51, right? It is.
Yes. Yeah, around 2005 revision, they added the definition, I believe, to Chapter 51. I don't believe it previously existed.
I want to go back to Justice Crooks's question. What difference does it really make to your client, whether it's a 51 or 55? We have, let's just accept, which I think you do, We have a woman who's in her mid-80s, right, who's suffering from Alzheimer's, a degenerative brain disorder. And she's, if she were a child, we would say she's acting out, right? She's engaging in behavior that is not acceptable under the circumstances. She's hitting. She won't take medication. She might not have taken food. I mean, there may be any number of behavior issues, right, from Alzheimer's. Might be hoarding, antagonism to people, etc. So what can she get under 51? I'm looking at it from her perspective. How can anything that happens under 51 help her rather than what would happen under 55 to helping her? And I know there are problems because she might not want to be, quote, helped. But in terms of her being able to, one, survive physically, which may be an issue of physical survival, as well as others around her, and we're interested in that too, right? The community cannot tolerate violence. So what difference does it make if she's under 51 or she's under 55? I think that's the question, and I'm not sure I understand the answer. Yeah.
There's nothing that she gets in a benefit under 51 that she can't also get under 55. Okay. And that the 55 system's designed to be friendly, caring. The 51 system's designed to treat a narrow group of dangerous individuals.
This is one you say is more confrontational in the sense it deals with the guardian and her family. I view this one as confrontational and dealing with making things involuntary. But so, and others have asked you this, can she be placed in a psychiatric ward?
She cannot under 55. Okay. She can under 51.
All right. Does she need to be placed in a psychiatric ward?
My contention would be no. She can be provided psychotropic medications without being in a locked psychiatric ward.
What about other kinds of medication?
Sure. I mean,
a little Valium.
Well, whatever the medical people would think.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I know that's not usually viewed as psychotropic. Yeah. Sometimes a little wine calms people down.
Could use some now myself.
and I don't mean to be funny because I've seen it with Alzheimer's patients. So, what can your answer to Justice Crooks's question or mine, whichever you prefer, is everything she needs and everything the nursing home needs in order to be able to maintain her, what the family needs in order to maintain her in some kind of entity, institution if you prefer, she can get under 55.
Those services can be provided under 55, yes.
Does 55, I'm trying to remember back, and having Watts hearings and Watts reviews, and I thought it was an annual hearing that you have under 55, and it's oftentimes it's not very exciting. Most usually no one even shows up, but still you're on the record and you have the hearing, you decide should they still be protected for the place, and it's an annual review, if I'm remembering this right. Is that still the case?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And with Alzheimer's patients, obviously things are not going to get better. They're not going to change. It's going to be a permanent condition. There are annual reviews to assure things are being done correctly, and the guardian there has a function to keep an eye on making sure my family member, the person I care for, is being taken care of properly.
Right. The judge has to, I mean, it's not to say the judge has a lot of reading to do before going on the record for these hearings that no one tends to show up for. But you have to make all new findings based upon reports and submissions and things that are there in that. But it's an annual review. 51, why am I thinking that's a six-month commitment, and it has to be, it could be extended, but, I mean, it's 6 months, and that person's back. Why doesn't that maybe even protect the person?
Well, it's pointless for an Alzheimer's patient, and again, that's why I think the legislature put that in Chapter 55, is 6 months isn't going to make a difference for these folks. They're going to need care for the rest of their lives. 51 recognizes there's some acute disorders that we can treat with medicine, and there's a good chance that can be done quickly. Now, there's a lot of patients, it ends up being a year after year extension, which can be a lot of years. But it's potential it's only 6 months, and those people will be, I won't say cured, but made functional so they can return to society.
Did the guardian of Helen oppose the petition to transfer this action into a Chapter 51 action?
The record's not clear on that, unfortunately. There's one last thing I really think is important and I want to address, my point four, which can easily get in trouble when you put numbers up on what you're going to say. And that is the potential impact of a decision that a person with Alzheimer's can be committed under 51 on powers of a healthcare attorney actions. And the ability of the attorney to admit a patient into some kind of treatment or residential or nursing home facility. Pursuant to statute, if a person is deemed to have a mental illness, that power of health care cannot be applied. And I don't think any sleight of hand by calling it a behavioral disturbance is going to resolve that problem. The very nature of these health care agreements is to allow a family to plan ahead of time and decide their own fate without the courts intervening. Most of the time, it's done well in advance of the date the admission is going to occur. But the assessment of mental illness is made on the date of the admission. Usually, the decision to put somebody in a nursing home or something is because they are beginning to act out and can't stay at home any longer. To suggest that mental or Alzheimer's with a behavioral disturbance is a mental illness is basically going to thwart that option. And certainly nursing homes who are subject to licensure in terms of who they can accept into an institution are going to have a hard time parsing out the Alzheimer's from a behavioral disorder and going to be reluctant to admit anyone who's going to be in this circumstance.
My question to you is this. One of the issues I hear from people around this state and elsewhere is they have a family member who is having behavioral difficulties. Let's not try and isolate the cause thereof. And that they fall into the cracks of the statutes. And that the family can't do anything about it. No one is going to be able to do anything. And this person whom people want to protect from themselves and protect from others who might be abusing them, and there's nothing in the statutes to help. So if you should succeed, what happens to Helen?
I don't think...
Where is she now?
She's in a nursing facility, subject to an extended 51.
So what difference does it make to her if she's in a nursing facility in 51 or she's under a 55 placement?
And again, it's the surrounding focus of what this, the commitment is for, the availability of a guardian to keep an eye. Well, she has a guardian independently. For her specifically, it may not make as much difference as it will for many other people who are put into this system, especially the 51 system.
Why? That's what I'm trying to get at. What difference does it make? Keep coming back to that.
It's the very nature of the purpose of 51 is incompatible with the nature of these patients. Okay.
And the real point may be that it's a potential impact on the power of attorney. That so some could carefully be
critical,
set up.
Critical down the road, especially with the growing number of Alzheimer's patients we expect to have because of the demographics. That basically all this years of planning ahead of time could be pointless and worthless when somebody wanted to control their fate and now it's going to be tossed.
Is there a case that says that, or is that just the concern of counsel?
It's a concern on many levels, yeah. One last thing, and to answer the question, for the person who is facing somebody in their family member who's a problem, if they're obviously, if they're not an Alzheimer's senile individual so that they're subject to 55, they could be under 51 because they have some other kind of mental disorder. If it's senility and Alzheimer's, then Chapter 55 has emergency placement where you can call the police and the 55 process can commence with, you know, psychotropic medications as a one of the conditions of that. So the 55 system has avenues available to address these particular problems. And my time is clearly up, so thank you.
Council. Mr. Bent.
Well, the legislative intent is to provide the care and treatment that a person needs under both Chapter 51 and Chapter 55. The issue in this case is not whether you could have done a protective placement. It's whether the Chapter 51 petition was legally brought and whether the standards were met. And Dr. Roski's testimony was uncontroverted in the record. His medical judgment was that she did have a mental illness under the statute. He used various terms in when he testified, he used the word behavioral disturbances rather than dementia. But she does meet the criterion for mental illness under the statute. And she was a subject for treatment. You can commit people who are developmentally disabled. And under opposing counsel's, he was saying, well, if you can't get any better, developmentally disabled people are permanently disabled. But they can be committed under Chapter 51. The controlling case is in the matter of CJ. It says, an individual with an incurable physical or mental illness or disability may still be considered capable of rehabilitation and able to benefit from treatment in the sense that the symptoms can be controlled and the ability to manage the illness ameliorated.
That was a case involving a paranoid schizophrenic who had a illness that was not curable, but the doctor said the delusions that were symptomatic from that mental illness were susceptible to rehabilitation, which is part of the definition of treatment, and therefore could be a 51. That's your strongest argument, that case, I think.
But Helen E.F. had agitation and anxiety and depression. They were mental conditions that produced the behaviors of physically striking out and being a danger to others and to herself.
And the record, in the report, the doctor did not say that those constituted mental illness. In his testimony, did he say that the agitation was a mental illness?
He said he called that the behavioral disturbances.
Yeah, associated with her dementia.
But the cause of the illness, I believe, is irrelevant. But did she benefit? The treatment, first, she was in the hospital for a relatively short period of time and then went back to the nursing home. That was the goal of the treatment. It gave her greater peace of mind and well-being, so she no longer felt like striking out, hitting and punching and kicking caregivers. People she knew for 6 years. She had been in that nursing home a long time. It increased her ability to cooperate with required activities of daily living, including feeding, medication, and hygiene. It reduced the potential for infection and mortality. Dr. Roski's report clearly stated, Helen E.F.'s acute risk of harm to herself and others remained a daily concern, given the need for treatment staff to assist her with daily cares in order to reduce the potential for morbidity and mortality associated with medical illnesses and infection. This was a life and death issue. Chapter 51 is readily available to treat someone with a mental illness as defined under the statute to benefit them, as I've just noted how she was benefited. It restored a measure of dignity to her life, and her treatment was required on an inpatient psychiatric unit. It took them over 30 days to find the right levels of and kind of medication in order to treat her. This was not an easy case to treat. And yet she was able to return after successful treatment to the nursing home setting where she was, and she didn't have a guardian. She had a health care agent, and I know it's not in the record, but the agent was absolutely in favor of this. Family never opposed this at all.
Under Chapter 55, can she be held in a locked facility?
No. You cannot be in a psychiatric unit under Chapter 55. It says so right in Chapter 55.12. The only way you can go to would be on an emergency detention or a commitment under Chapter 51.20. So she had no way
right.
to get.
But is a locked facility always a psychiatric facility?
Well, a psychiatric facility can be locked. Most of them are locked. But you cannot place someone in a psychiatric facility under Chapter 55.
Okay, but can they be in a locked facility? Not a psychiatric facility, but a locked facility under 55.
That would be a nursing home. So that would not be a psychiatric facility.
Can they be administered psychotropic medication involuntarily in a locked nursing home?
Not very well. It doesn't work. Psychiatrists, where she was living, there was a psychiatrist who'd go there once a month, if that. They're not going to make home calls to go to a nursing home, nor can they monitor and see that patient and observe how the patient is doing, nor can you keep that patient from being a danger to others as she strikes out, and particularly to herself when she won't even allow them to clean her up from urine. And as a result, she developed two urinary tract infections, which Dr. Roski testified he believed that was the cause. This was necessary. This was done to help her. We don't do these because we want to. We do them because they're necessary and because people meet the criterion, of course, and it helps them. I mean, you can second guess the decision of why we didn't do Chapter 55, but I know one thing. She's alive today, and she's doing well. And she has a higher quality of life today because of what we did. That's what the Chapter 51 system is for. Mental health treatment's advanced. It treats the disorders. It doesn't just sedate somebody. Psychiatric units aren't dungeons. St. Agnes Behavioral Health is a wonderful, caring, compassionate place. And she got wonderful, caring, compassionate care at that place. And as a result, she improved, and she's back in the nursing home where she belongs. And that should be legal.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Bent. And thank you, Mr. Lang, for your arguments on chapters 51, 55 relating to Alzheimer's. Which is, as you both point out, a disease that affects many people, and as the population ages, will affect many more. So this is a very important case for the state. This ends our hearing on 10 AP 2061, Fond du Lac County versus Helen E.F. The students should stay. Justice Crooks will be out in a few moments. The court will resume after lunch at 1:30 for its third argument today. We are in recess.